Welcome to the podcast series from the National Centre for Research Methods at the University of Southampton. In today's podcast, Professor Roz Edwards talks about a pilot project looking at the para data in Peter Townsend's seminal research from the 1960s on poverty in the UK.
As far as I can gather, no consensus about what is para data, but very broadly, I think most people would accept that it's the byproducts of social research, and it's usually used to refer to survey research. So that a survey will be carried out on a particular topic, but as part of collecting that data, other sorts of data is collected. So you could collect what's called macro para data, which is about how long an interview took, what sort of wait there was before an interviewee answered questions, how long it took to arrange an interview, how many calls had to be made. Those sorts of things are macro para data. But there's also what's called micro para data, which are more sort of qualitative, if you like. They're more about interviewers' perceptions of perhaps what a street looked like or the state of a house or whatever. So that it covers those two things for the most part.
So why are researchers like yourself interested in what might be described, I suppose, as a sort of a byproduct of survey data?
Because they want to improve the quality of surveys. They want to improve their data collection, people's participation rates, the quality of the data that they collect, the answers that people give to questions. And they want to keep the cost down. So para data can help survey researchers think about those issues. But one of the things that is less clear for survey researchers is how they can handle the micro para data, the more observant para data. And we thought we can bring a qualitative perspective to that that might help illuminate how that sort of micro para data can help survey researchers.
Okay, so tell us a bit about this particular project then, the background to it and how it came about.
Well, I'm a member of the National Centre for Research Methods, and we promote work across methodological expertise as well as within methodological expertise. And so part of that was thinking, well, bringing a qualitative perspective onto a quantitative issue, if you like, is crossing boundaries. And within that, the people I collaborated with were experts in narrative, so we were bringing together two sorts of methodological expertise. One was thematic analysis, and the other was the narrative analysis. So a key issue for us as a collaborative research team as part of ENCRM was, can we use narrative analysis on micro para data?
Now, you made use of one of the most pivotal studies ever undertaken, Poverty in the UK by Peter Townsend. Why did you make use of that particular study?
The quick answer is because it was there and because it was influential. It was carried out in 1967 to 68 in the field across the whole of the UK. And the interviews were carried out with over 3,500 households, the members of those households. And they were carried out using paper booklets. And those booklets, they're quite large and thick, but they're archived in the UK Data Archive. And they have marginal notes that the field workers made around the edge of the questions, noting all different sort of para data about responses to how they felt about how the interview went, some additional information and so on. And that ranges from really brief comments through to quite extensive paragraphs of material. So that was there, it was available. It's, as you say, it was an influential study that brought about a major shift in how we understand and measure poverty. So that enabled us to try out the narrative analysis on para data, but also to make us think about how we could deal with the historical specificity of the data. The other reason we used it is because there was no such contemporary data available.
So, I mean, I'm going to ask you in a moment about some of the sorts of things that they did write about in those margins, and I think that they're going to be fascinating examples. But before I do, what were you specifically looking for and at, and why?
Well, we were very interested in how the field workers were actually bound up, implicated in the process of data collection. detection and coding, and then what the implications of that might be for data quality. So we analysed the material in two ways. We firstly did a thematic analysis, and then we did a narrative analysis. And for the thematic analysis, we selected some booklets that had quite a lot of paradata in them from particular areas that the project had been carried out in. And we looked through them for the recurring types or forms of paradata, and we found six different types. One of them was amplification, where the field workers were writing figures or background clarification of issues. So, for example, they'd be adding up someone's income in the margin in order to code it. Then there were justificatory paradata, which was why the field worker had chosen to code it in a particular way that justified that decision, or why they couldn't put a code in there. Or another form was explanation, where they were talking about or writing about the actual topic, about people's housing circumstances, or their job and so on. And there's evaluatory paradata, which is writing about people's characters or their material circumstances, and also being evaluative in terms of making judgments on whether they were telling the truth or speculating about some of the issues behind what they were saying. Another form of paradata was debriefing. So they would be writing a debrief to themselves to sort of explain to themselves what was going on, and also addressing the core research team back in the central office to explain to them how the interview went. And then there were various forms of standpoint paradata about the political or social context, but also, interestingly, about personal acts that we might think of as beyond the field worker role today. So, for example, tucking an old lady up in bed at the end of the interview because she was tired, or getting in touch with citizens' advice.
So what did the narrative analysis involve?
We selected six booklets because narrative analysis is a very in-depth, time-consuming process. And we did a close reading of all the marginalia as telling a particular sort or genre of story, and how the field worker positioned themselves and their informant within that. So, for example, the field worker might be writing a story that positioned them as this sceptical detective who was uncovering the truth, with the informant there obfuscating in some way. Or another story was positioning the field worker as very diligent and competent in obtaining data under quite difficult circumstances, and therefore that positioned the informant as somehow incompetent and difficult.
So those were the types of things that you were looking at. It would be great to have one or two examples, particularly of things that maybe caught your eye specifically or really captured your interest.
Some of them would be quite funny or ironic. So there was one comment against a question about the amount of any one-off exceptional grant that had been received. And the field worker wrote, presumably based on the cost of living index 1899. And so that would be a standpoint, if you like. And then another one was against a question about looking for work. And the field worker commented, she wants, in inverted commas, she wants to get a job, but is not really seriously trying. And those sort of fall into the evaluation and justification themes. But also there could be some really poignant comments, marginalia. And so there's an extract from the notes on the interview as a whole with an 83-year-old woman. And the field worker wrote, it was rather sad. Informant had lived alone for 2 years. Sister died in 1966. Informant kept on crying. On this bright summer evening, we sat in front parlour with curtains drawn and lights on. Newspapers covered the good chairs. And it went on like that. Those are very touching.
Absolutely. I mean, I wonder whether for you this, you know, painted something of a picture of interviewers of that time, people who were out there conducting this social research on behalf of academics.
Yes, I think one of the things that struck us was they were independent and resourceful. They, you know, there was no mobiles, no emails, so they went off into the field sometimes for a week at a time. And they were, you know, unless they could get to a telephone box or staying in a bed and breakfast with a telephone, that was it. So they're quite resourceful. What is evident through looking at the marginalia is that the skill that was involved in gathering the data and in sustaining an interview, moving backwards and forwards between the different answers and so on as the person delivered the information. I think also it's really clear to us that from the marginalia that the interviewers were trying or attempting to make meaning meaning out of the lives of the participants. They were attempting also to make meaning out of the project. What is this project about? And the expectations that the central team held of them and their own feelings. So there are all these different issues that come into play in how those field workers were working. Also, there was, as I indicated, that some of them had that social care role that went beyond the field worker role. And also, a few of them had a really strong political commitment to the survey itself.
It's absolutely fascinating. But all this must have thrown up some ethical issues around interviewers and the way in which they also recorded the data. What's your take on that?
I suppose the main issue that it would throw up is around informed consent. The issue of informed consent for us, because these field workers hadn't given permission for us to use their paradata half a century later or so. But actually, within the practice of poverty in the UK itself, from today's perspective, I do stress that, there was a lack of informed consent, because the sort of narrative analysis that we did around how the field workers viewed themselves and positioned the informants within that, it's very clear that not all of the informants actually understood why the field worker was there, why they had come. And that 83-year-old woman, for example, she didn't really understand whether this person was from the council or was a researcher. She didn't know what was going on. And that was clear from the field worker's notes. There are also some indications that field workers would really push and override the reluctance of someone to take part. And there is one interview that I remember that was carried out in the hall, again with an elderly lady who had bad knees, carried out in the hall because the lady didn't want to let the person in. And she was obviously giving any answers to make this researcher go away, but the researcher was pushing and pushing to get at the truth, to be a competent field worker. So those sorts of scenarios raise issues around, well, what is the quality of the data that if you do not get informed consent and you push someone to participate, what is the quality of the data that you end up with? But we don't want to be censorious about this, because we have to take care not to be anachronistic in terms of our ethical lens. We have to remember the historical context, as I said.
Absolutely. This was another time, another era. We're talking 50 years ago. That brings me on to my question of how it relates to today, because so much has changed, hasn't it, in terms of how these types of social interviews are carried out and the rules and regulations around them, and the procedures are that much stricter, clearer, more careful. And there's a lot of legal ramifications as well, aren't there?
There are. And there are questions, not just with this project, but with other classic projects, as to whether they would ever have got ethical approval. There are technology shifts in terms of survey research, obviously move from notepads to iPads, if you like. And as I say, there's this constant contact that field workers have with their supervisors that these field workers didn't have. And there's massive social change. There was the expectation that housewives would be at home during the day that we can't have today as well.
Did you feel you learned something about the professional role of the field worker and how they fit into research?
One change that struck us is that the political commitment of the core research team and some of the field workers would not be so obvious today. Today, people would want to be portraying an overt objectivity. And I think the field worker role is more hidden today than it was previously, but it's still there. When people are doing face-to-face survey interviews, it is still a relationship, a co-construction, if you like, between the field worker and the informant. I would presume that field workers still need to practice this great resourcefulness and skills to actually gather the data and take people through an interview. I should imagine perhaps that some of them still push for data. That still goes on. And so that does have consequences today for how we think about data quality. So we think that from our project that there are lessons about the implications for briefing researchers in the field, for data collection processes, for the coding and data quality, and also for the ethics of carrying out survey research.
Ross Edwards carried out the research with Anne Phoenix, Heather Elliott and Janet Boddy. You can find out more information about the research on the NCRM website at www.ncrm.ac.uk. Aspects of the research are also being presented at the ESRC Research Methods Festival in July.